I love the sound of breaking glass. J'espère que vous êtes bien à notre écoute. Notre lunchtime en anglais continue avec la chronique Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro. I need the noises of destruction.
Bro, on the Global Literary Beat, Breaking Glass. Today's episode is an excerpt from the latest Harry Palmer novel. In this chapter from The House That Buff Built, about the LA real estate industry in the early 50s and the contemporary housing crisis which ensued from it, Harry is hired to make sure a Chinese woman can move into a segregated suburban town without being harmed. On the drive out to Torrance the next morning, I had the radio tuned to my favorite rhythm and blues station, not only because I liked the music, but also because I knew my ex-girlfriend Denisha had a new album and I wanted to see if they were playing anything from it. Instead, what I got was the latest news on the Senate campaign. The Republican, Representative Nixon, Richard by name, was running a smear campaign against his female Democratic rival, Helen Gehagan Douglas. The newscaster on the Negro station was as suspicious of this guy from the all-white town of Whittier as I was. In his latest salvo, Nixon claimed that Douglas was not only a commie pinko, but in a lowball, he said she was pink right down to her underpants. If she were elected, he claimed, with the country now at war in Korea against what the government said were communists in the North, she would establish a beachhead on which to launch an attack on the U.S. I didn't like the guy because I thought he was slimy, oozing corruption from every pore, but his hate and fear campaign seemed to be working. He was pulling ahead in the polls. Nothing I could do about that, but just as the news ended and they were getting back to playing music, I arrived in Torrance. On the drive from downtown, I went through the Negro section of North Compton, said to be a battleground, as overcrowded Negro tenants attempted to move south where there was more room. Once out of Compton, though, the area became entirely white as I cruised through Gardena and then into Torrance. The address Sandra Chung gave me was right in the middle of town on Post Street in what looked to be its oldest section. The houses were well-maintained, but there was a look of sameness about them, with white exteriors over what looked to be very roomy 3 to 4 bedroom homes and generous, lovingly manicured lawns in front. The stores on nearby Cravens Avenue, pharmacy, toy store, real estate office, were composed of a red brick exterior giving the impression of any town USA and looking a bit like a Hollywood movie set of what a small town should be. Number 34, though, which was to be Sandra's new home, was perhaps a bit more honest about what small towns really were, showing me why I lived in the big, evil, corrupt city, which at least had the saving grace of displaying its gaudiness openly. On the lawn in front of this more modest two-bedroom home stood a gathering of folks, some of them carrying picket signs, or rather wielding them in a threatening manner, with slogans like, "Keep our town clean," and "We don't want any." The signs didn't take much translating. Clean meant white, and any meant, in this case, Chinese, or, as they would say, Mongolians. There were angry looks on the faces of the 20-odd neighbors who weren't being very neighborly. I parked my car a little way down the block and found Sandra and Lynn huddled in their car a little closer to the house, but far enough away so the crowd had not seen them. "Let's go," I said, rapping on the window and motioning for them to get out. Lynn was up to the challenge and again assumed an open stance with her hands, palms down, spread out in front of her, but her mother calmed her and made her put her hands at her sides. "Why did I want to do this, Mr. Palmer?" she said, grabbing my arm. "Yesterday, you wanted a better life for you and your daughter," I reminded her. "I'm sure that hasn't changed." We reached the house and started to walk up the sidewalk to the front door. It was a nicely constructed two-bedroom with a fence surrounding it and all kinds of bushes growing along the fence. The crowd parted, but some of them started yelling at her in unison for her to go home. "She is home," I said, wanting to add flame to the fire. "This is her home." The women scowled, and one or two of the men spit on the sidewalk directly in front of Sandra. They had parted on either side of the walkway as I pushed us through. As we reached the steps to the porch and as I escorted Sandra up onto the landing with Lynn following, one of the men pulled me back. He looked to be mid-40s, dressed in cotton shirt and gray slacks. I brushed him off, but he wanted to make his case. You see that tree over there, he said, pointing to an adjacent lawn with a mammoth structure with huge brown trunk and green leaves budding out of it? That's cork oak. It's rare in Southern California. It's a sign of strength and stability, and that's what you're threatening here, our strength and stability, he said. She's a dentist, I said. You ought to let her move in. She'll make the community stronger and more stable. He looked a little stunned, but behind him another man with pockmarks on his cheeks and looking to be a rougher customer chimed in. We don't want Chinese hordes taking over the neighborhood. I wondered if he was the one who left the flyer Sandra had found. What's your name, Bub? I said, reaching out to collar him. But two other men and a couple of the women stepped forward to push me back, and I decided I had better get in the house before this went any further. Inside, I found a short man in a suit sitting at the living room table, sweating, though it was still morning, and we hadn't yet got what was promising to be sweltering afternoon heat. I don't know why I'm doing this, he said, as Sandra sat patiently waiting for him to sign the deed of sale. Lynn, meanwhile, was up and pacing behind her mother. This is Mr. Barnum, Sandra said, motioning for me to sit. She told me the lawyers had already approved the sale and she was ready to write a check for the total amount. I just want to get out of here, the short man said, now practically cowering and folding himself into a bundle. They're calling me a race traitor, and I get all kinds of threatening notices and email. I had a feeling this might go badly, so I decided to divert Mr. Barnum. What's that flower? I said, pointing to a vase on the table with a mix of pink, white, and blue leaves sprouting from a jar. It's called a hybrid delphinium. It's our city flower. I used to be in the flower business, shipping them all around the country, but now I just want to retire and live in peace. And who's that? Lynn said, pointing to a photo of a Japanese man on Barnum's wall standing in front of a flower shop. He's the former owner of what was my shop before I sold it, the tiny man said. But he's Japanese. Did you take it from him when he was sent away during the war? Barnum blanched. So much for trying to brighten the mood. Lynn was just too bold for her young britches, and she wasn't finished yet. Barnum signed the deed silently and uttered a sigh of relief. Given Lynn's accusation, I wondered if he was also selling to an Asian owner out of some sense of guilt over whatever had gone down in his acquiring the shop. It was now up to Sandra. This was her big moment. Except it was not to be. Instead, Lynn, who was standing behind her, startled all of us. Lynn grabbed Sandra's pen. Then she pulled a jackknife from her pocket and slammed it down on her mother's copy of the contract. Grandfather would not want this, she said. Sandra quietly but firmly removed the knife, which had made only a small perforation in the contract. She handed it back to Lynn, admonishing her in a tone that was more patient than punishing. We don't know what my father would want, she said. We haven't seen him for almost a year, but we have to assume he wants the best for us. Now, let me have the pen. Lynn reluctantly turned it over and Sandra signed the deed. Barnum told Sandra she could move in immediately. He would be gone in a day just as soon as the deed was turned over to the city officials. She thanked him and we got up to leave. I thought of something and turned back to question Barnum, who at this point was preparing to go upstairs to his bedroom, probably to sleep the whole thing off. Who called you a race trader? I asked. He didn't reply, but instead went to a drawer in a desk near the table and pulled out some scattered pieces of paper. The words on the one he showed me were spilled out with letters drawn from different newspaper headlines. He had missed it, but I noticed that at the bottom of the page was a tiny inscription drawn from different newspaper articles. It read, KKK. The Klan was very active in these contested towns, and it caused a lot of trouble in border areas in LA County where new populations were trying to move. He then showed me another letter, what looked like a newspaper linotype. The letter was short, sweet, and to the point. It read simply, "If you sell, things will not go well for you." I thanked him, wished him luck, and led Sandra and Lynn out of the house. When we got out onto the porch, the crowd had thinned, probably realizing there was nothing they could do at the moment to stop this. As I led Sandra and Lynn down the sidewalk to their car, a few stragglers snarled at us. Sandra let it slide off her back, but Lynn turned to them and tightened her thin frame into what she thought of what she thought was a fighting machine. None of this would be a problem if we had a revolution here and private property was confiscated like in China, she said, glaring. Sandra collared her, leading her to the car, and I heard her say, "The revolution will do nothing for us except get us kicked out of this country." She then ordered Lynn to get in the passenger side. The few remaining protesters just had a blank look on their faces after what they had heard. I think they got yellow menace, but I don't believe they were well informed about the finer points of what was going on in China. Sandra thanked me and asked me to keep coming by the house to check on them. I agreed, but noticed Lynn rolling down the window and poking her nose outside the car. "Who are those two men?" she said. When I looked, whoever they were had gone. I saw two men on the side of the house in dark suits looking over the place, she said, looking at me for confirmation. And it's not the first time I've seen them. I didn't see anything, I said, but I'll check. I walked around the corner of the house, but there was no sign of anyone. When I got back, Sandra had pulled away, and I saw her and Lynn speeding back toward Chinatown. I decided to stay on the grounds for a while and see if the two men, if Lynn had really seen them, would return or if anyone else would show up to protest. What I saw instead was, two houses down, a beautiful young blonde in her early 30s with hair flowing down onto her shoulders. She was getting out of her car and meeting what appeared to be a client, a single man on the front lawn of another house with a for sale sign. I decided to check out the show. "Hello there, mister," she said. "I'm just showing this house, but if you're in the mood to buy, you can come along because there's plenty more where this came from." The client was an older man who seemed to be as taken with her as I was, although he was somewhat agitated about me moving into his territory. "I'm Diane Chestnut," she said, holding out her hand, first to him and then to me. "You're both going to like what I have to show you." She led us inside, describing the features as she showed us the three-bedroom, single-floor, spacious interior. "I work for Williams Housing," she said, "and this is one of our finest homes, though it's typical of the quality of all our homes." She pointed out the oak flooring, the genuine lathe and plaster construction, gave us a peek at the two custom baths, the brightly colored tile in the kitchen with its cedar roof, and let us have a look out the window at the equally spacious two-car garage. She wound it all up with her summary pitch. "A home," she said, "is a place of privilege, a place of happiness." She pronounced each of her words slowly with almost a breathless whisper. She had turned real estate into pillow talk. "Hey, maybe the suburbs are not so bad." And then she ruined it. "A home," she continued, "is also an investment which must be guarded and preserved against infiltration." I didn't think she meant bugs. I think she meant infiltration by those who were not, as she might put it, seemly, the way Sandra and Lynn were not seemly. She gave us each a card with her business phone, and when the older man left and I lingered, she went to her car. As she was getting in, she turned and blew me a kiss. The contrast between one population being lovingly seduced into entering a neighborhood and another being rudely repelled was striking, and it seemed arbitrary. I marked Miss Chestnut in my mind and wondered who or what was behind her. There were so many threats on the horizon for Sandra, who really only wanted a better life for her and her daughter. I hardly knew where to begin. And the house that Buff built is available on Nook, Kobo, Apple Books, Amazon, and wherever fine books are sold. Change of mind, sound
of breaking glass. Dennis Bro is the author of Film Noir, American Workers and Postwar Hollywood, Class Crime and International Film Noir, and Maverick or How the West Was Lost. Is hyper-industrialism and television seriality the end of leisure and the birth of the binge? Nothing new, sound of breaking glass. C'était Breaking Glass de Dennis Bro sur Art District. Très bonne suite de nos programmes, jazzistiques et artistiques, à notre écoute.